pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. You may be seated. Justice Piper is obviously not here this morning, but he will be participating on the decisions in the cases we hear. The first case is 02-1460 Columbus Bar Association versus Gina Mary Dougherty. Ms. McQuain.
May it please the court, I'm Jill Snitcher McQuain on behalf of Relator, Columbus Bar Association. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
As the record reflects, this case is now before the court for a second time. The case was previously heard and remanded. A second hearing was held, resulting in the instant findings and recommendations of the Board of Commissioners on grievances and discipline that the respondent receive a public reprimand. We're here today based solely on the issue of whether a public reprimand is an appropriate sanction under the circumstances. Relator contends that the sanction should be increased on the theory that a public reprimand is inadequate to redress the respondent's deliberate falsification of an affidavit jurat. We believe that an 18-month suspension with 12 months stayed is a more appropriate sanction under the circumstances. The board found that the respondent's improper notarization constituted a violation of disciplinary rule 1-102A4, that the lawyer committed a dishonest act. And by this court's own dictates, violations of 1102A4 warrant a much harsher sanction than a public reprimand. Office of Disciplinary Counsel versus Fauerbaugh is patently clear. Violations of disciplinary rule 1-102A4 warrant an actual suspension. The respondent has pointed to several cases which deviate from this mandate in support of the proposition that she received nothing more than a public reprimand. But since this ruling was issued nearly 10 years ago, the court cited to Fauerbaugh in 40 different disciplinary proceedings. And in 75% of those cases, the court adhered to the mandates of Fauerbaugh and suspended 30 attorneys. The courts really only departed from Fauerbaugh where the evidence supports that the infraction is an isolated incident and where the respondent can prove significant mitigation.
The respondent, as you know, goes through case by case the cases that were cited and indicates that, argues that in each of those cases there were some circumstances that were more severe than in this case. You want to comment on respondents?
What we have attempted to do, Your Honor, is to list the full range of cases involving notary violations so that you can see that the sanctions run anywhere from a permanent disbarment to a state suspension, depending upon the particular facts and circumstances involved. We believe that the facts and circumstances involved in this particular instant are worthy of an 18-month suspension with 12 months stay.
May I ask you to comment what would happen if this were not an attorney who falsified a notary, but if it was just a notary who falsified a notary? What is the punishment in that instance, if you know?
The statutory punishment is a fine of up to $100 and up to 30 days in jail.
Okay, thank you.
The court has departed from Fauerbaugh, as I said, only where the evidence supports an isolated incident and mitigation. The respondent's attempting to hang her hat on these handful of cases, claiming that her conduct amounted to nothing more than an isolated incident, and citing several factors which she urges the court to consider mitigation. Relator contends that this is far more than an isolated lapse of judgment. This is the egregious conduct of an attorney experienced in the area of liquor law to engage in a deliberate course of conduct to deceive a state agency to obtain the desired results of her client. And by her misconduct, the respondent set into place a series of events to improperly achieve her client's goals.
Should we be distinguishing? I mean, if an attorney, whether it's a will, whether it's a deed, whether it's a divorce document, all those we've had before, if an attorney falsifies the signature line or signs without the witness, you know, seeing the actual affiant sign it and that sort of thing. Does it matter what it was for? Is the act itself what we should be looking at? I mean, if a will is done versus a liquor license, does that really make a difference?
I would direct the court's attention to the decision issued in Lorain County Bar Association versus Papke, where the court went into an extensive discussion about the fact that that an attorney's misuse of her powers as a notary constitutes a fraud on the court where the documents are filed and on all those who rely on such documents. To the extent it depends on what sort of document it is, I'm not sure that that would make a difference.
I mean, the fact of the matter is you're committing a fraud of some sort by saying you saw the witness sign when you didn't, or you made your secretary sign it when she didn't see it. And what you did it for really is pretty secondary, isn't it?
That would be our argument, yes.
Counsel, does it have any bearing on the consequences of the illegal or improper notarization, such as in this case, where it was alleged that an organization was involved in the charitable purpose for the issuance of the liquor license with a restaurant that actually, I guess, did not comport with their religious laws. It was a non-kosher restaurant, et cetera, and that seemed to put the organization, at least internally, in turmoil.
That's correct. It did cause some harm to the organization in terms of its reputation. But I would submit to this court that perhaps the focus on the lack of harm that respondent argues here today is perhaps overemphasized based on the fact that ultimately the respondent's client got what he wanted in the end. So there was no harm to the client per se. But yes, there was some harm to the organization involved. And I believe that there's harm to the profession in the sense that this attorney bent the rules to achieve her client's objectives. Testimony at the hearing demonstrated that the Division of Liquor Control does in fact rely on the fact that an attorney has reviewed the liquor permit application and is in agreement that there are no errors or misrepresentations contained in the application. Respondent's misconduct in this instance was not inconsequential. There was a material reliance on the misrepresentations that she made within that application. But even if this court agrees that the respondent in this instance conduct amounted to nothing more than an isolated incident, I direct the court's attention to a couple of different cases, Akron Bar Association versus Coombs. In that case, the respondent improperly notarized a signature on a lease that the respondent had not witnessed. And the court acknowledged that this was an isolated incident. It also acknowledged the mitigation in the sense that the attorney had no prior disciplinary record and completely cooperated in the disciplinary proceedings. And yet the court still imposed a 6-month stayed suspension. Likewise, in Office of Disciplinary Counsel versus Hefter, the respondent received a 6-month stayed suspension where the court, where the conduct was remarkably similar to that at issue today, being that it involved arguably an isolated incident with mitigating factors that the respondent is attempting to argue today.
Counsel, you're talking or pointing us to cases where the entire suspension was stayed.
Yes.
Okay, and in this particular case, you're actually asking for 6 months out.
Yes.
In essence. Why would you go the extra measure of actual suspension as opposed to 18 months with the entire amount stayed?
The cases I've just cited involve an isolated incident, and the court acknowledged that. I don't think that this particular case involved an isolated incident. I think that the respondent's conduct in this situation set into place a series of events that misled a state agency.
Well, are you talking about an isolated incident of one improper notarization of this document, or are you talking about other improper notarizations?
What I'm trying to set forth is that the court, in some circumstances, where they have determined that it is an isolated incident, being that all the attorney did was perhaps improperly notarize a document, that a six-month state suspension is appropriate. My argument is that this was more than just an improper notarization. She set into place a series of events which resulted in the filing of this fraudulent document with a government agency. It wasn't just the improper notarization, it's the entirety of the situation.
So when you say an isolated incident, you're distinguishing between a document that's notarized inappropriately and then tucked in a drawer someplace, or is not filed, for example. Here, you're calling it more than an isolated incident because of the consequences to the involvement of the liquor agency, the client, as well as this Jewish organization.
Yes.
Okay. Hear you say isolated incident versus non-isolated incident, I hear you saying more than one occasion she notarized, and okay. We do not have those facts in front of us.
That's right. That's correct.
I have the same, concern that Justice O'Connor does about whether we call this one isolated incident with extenuating circumstances that arose from that or that flowed from that, or whether we call it more than an isolated incident because there were circumstances that occurred. Wouldn't we be wiser and wouldn't it follow our test that we've established to say that if we want to have her be actually suspended for a period of time, to say that there are circumstances that arose from her illegal conduct, improper conduct, rather than to call this your brief sounds as if she really intended to cause the harm she caused, which that really isn't true. That in some instances, that the person knows that they're going to cause, they knowingly commit an act that is false. Here, she violated the statute on notary publics, but she did not. She didn't realize that the person whose signature she was notarizing was not the person who had actually signed the document, is she?
But I would argue that that is the very purpose of the notary's attestation, is to prevent circumstances
sure.
like that.
Sure, there's no question about that. But in terms of us writing a test so that lawyers know, we've written on these obviously a number of times, and still some lawyers don't get it, that you have to have the person attest to you that that's their signature. And here we have another case, and which different facts, obviously. But it seems to me that we ought to keep our test that we've established, that an isolated incident is one incident. I think you tried, in fact, to find other documents in her records that would indicate that she had done this more than once, but that wasn't successful, apparently. Is that true?
That's correct.
Okay.
I'm going to shift now to the mitigation. In presenting the mitigation, respondent has attempted to argue that her considerable experience somehow diminishes the severity of her conduct. But I would submit that this experience shouldn't necessarily be considered mitigation, but potentially aggravation, in the sense that this is an attorney with over 20 years of experience, and she simply should have known better. And in spite of her qualifications, which include considerable experience in the area of liquor law, she deliberately committed an unethical act, the consequences of which could easily have been avoided had she simply taken the requisite steps to verify the authenticity of the signature. The respondent goes on to claim that her lack of knowledge on the application should be considered mitigation. The fact that she didn't realize it was a forgery should somehow be considered mitigation. Again, though, I don't think that lack of knowledge under these circumstances should be considered mitigation.
Well, counsel, doesn't that really just go to the intent? And as the Chief Justice has mentioned, we're looking at a single act with unintended consequences to the organization that, was, if at the very least, embarrassed by her behavior. And there's a distinction that's already been made between the intent to cause harm and the unintended. You see no distinction there.
Well, I think, you know, there were a lot of red flags here for this attorney, an experienced attorney in liquor law. She hadn't witnessed the signature. She didn't have any familiarity with the affiant, and she had a client with a vested monetary interest in obtaining the privilege to sell alcohol at his establishment. These should have, at a minimum, raised some red flags for her to start asking some questions to verify the authenticity of the signature. And I don't, you know, whether or not the respondent knew the signature was a forgery is, in my mind, immaterial. She knew, plain and simple, that her own juret was not an honest statement. I want to take a brief moment just to address the respondent's criticism of the cases we've cited in support of a suspension. The respondent suggested that the cases we've cited are distinguishable, and in some circumstances they are. The cases we've cited in some circumstances involve more egregious conduct, but I don't think that that renders their consideration moot. The cases we've cited also contain varying sanctions, as I've indicated earlier, and we would submit that the respondent's conduct in this particular situation falls somewhere in the middle.
Ms. McQueen, let me ask you, this seems to be a case in which the respondent is not likely to repeat this conduct. Do you agree with that? Is there anything in the record that would indicate here that she's likely to repeat this conduct if she's suspended, or even with the stayed suspension?
I'm not sure there's anything in the record one way or the other on that point. You know, we had argued that, you know, it wasn't just this instance, but that claim was dismissed, and we stand by the dismissal. But I do believe that, you know, she is an experienced attorney in liquor law area, and to the extent that she continues to practice in that area, I would wonder.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm wondering if we believe that she should actually be suspended, would not just a straight 6-month suspension without the year or whatever it is with probation be more appropriate here? Usually, when we enter a suspended or a suspension that is part of which is stayed, it's because we kind of want to keep a watch on the lawyer. We have a system watch the lawyer to make sure that he or she is acting the way we think they should. Here, I don't quite see that. I mean, she made an egregious mistake, obviously, because the consequences it had violated the statute, but. It didn't appear to me from reading the briefs that she's likely to repeat this conduct. What's your response?
I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. I think that some suspension is warranted, and if this court determines that it's suspension in total as opposed to part of it stayed, we think that would support the misconduct in this case.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. McQueen. Mr. Weber.
May it please the court. Ms. Dougherty is seated at council table to my left along with Mr. Stern. Let me start by saying that the panel and board have now twice recommended a public reprimand in this case. They have concluded that this is a single isolated incident that is not likely to occur again. Twice we have that finding. It's a simple notary violation case. Ms. Dougherty has admitted that she made a mistake. She acknowledged her wrongdoing coming up on, I believe, 4 years ago. And here we are today for the second time before this court. Relator wants actual time off in this case because it believes that it was a, quote, deliberate course of conduct intended to deceive a state agency, close quote. That's right out of the brief at page 9. That's the crux of the argument for actual time off. The problem with that argument is that there's no evidence to support it, despite the fact that relators had 3.5 years to try to prove it.
Well, counsel, isn't the actual deception worked upon the agency is that as a notary, I am attesting that this is the signature of the applicant. That's pure and simple deceit.
And there is that A4 finding. I mean, there's no question. She admitted that she should have had Mr. Pollack sitting across her desk to sign that document. Instead, she relied on her client. Her client came in with the document and said, Leon Pollack has executed this document. Can you notarize it? She should have said, no. I'm going to go find Leon Pollack, and I'm going to go have him sign this in front of me. That's what she should have done, and she's admitted that. It's nothing more than that.
But that is deceitful activity in filing that document, notarizing it, and filing it with the Liquor Commission.
It is a deceitful conduct because she has represented on that document that the affidavit is sitting across from her. So in that context, yes.
Okay.
And she is willing to accept the responsibility for that mistake.
But I think your distinction is that she didn't know that he didn't actually sign it. I mean, there seems to be a qualitative difference or an intent difference between knowing somebody forged a document and notarizing a forged document versus just not doing your proper notary duties. Is that what the distinction is?
That's exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor. Mr. Wong, the owner of this restaurant, went out with this permit application. He went to one of his investors, Mr. Masser, who's a member of this men's club, and Mr. Masser forged Mr. Pollack's name to the document. We later stipulated 2.5 years ago that that was unbeknownst to Ms. Dougherty, that this forgery had occurred. Mr. Wong comes back to see Ms. Dougherty and represents to her that Mr. Pollack had in fact signed the document. Go ahead and notarize it so that we can get this filed. She relied upon him. That was a mistake. There's no question. But she had no knowledge of the forgery taking place, and she relied upon her client's representation. And this is a longtime client that she had had.
Counsel, if Ms. Dougherty was not an attorney and these same facts applied, what would be the appropriate sanction for the violation? As you know, $100 fine, up to 30 days in jail. I think all of us are concerned about the sanction here.
I believe the statute authorizes the $100 fine and up to 30 days in jail. I don't believe this warrants any jail time, certainly. A fine, perhaps, I think, if she were a non-lawyer. Again, because this is a single isolated event, and the board has twice found that this is not likely to occur again.
So you're analogizing the public reprimand to a fine if she were not an attorney?
I suppose that's right, Your Honor.
Whereas the appellant here is, I would say, suggesting this may be a more important case, potentially involving jail time.
I believe that that's the analogy they're trying to make. The big difference is there that this disciplinary process is not designed to punish. It's to protect the public. And that's a key distinction. And this board has twice found that this is not likely to occur again.
Well, counsel, isn't another consequence or intent of the disciplinary is to forewarn other attorneys, to educate them as to the wrongdoing and the consequences, what constitutes a violation and the consequences?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you look at the case law from this court that we've cited to in our brief, that this court has on several occasions issued a public reprimand when there has been a notary violation, isolated event, and there's mitigating factors. We think our case falls squarely within that line of case law. I want to quote from the two findings by the board. Twice now this board has made the following finding. There was no testimony or evidence to indicate that Ms. Dougherty was aware the F2 permit application form had been improperly signed or that she had any knowledge of any impropriety in the application of this permit. That's now twice that finding has been made. The panel and board have now twice dismissed allegations of DR 7101A3 and DR 7102A4, 5, and 6. Those are the facts of this case.
Mr. Weber, let me ask you, should this court include in its standard or its test for the severity of the sanction we are going to impose, the consequences of the act? Here, the client arguably was not harmed, but certainly the temple was. And should we not include that in our standard, or do you think we should just look at her conduct here, which apparently was not intended to cause the harm that she caused?
I think it's appropriate for this court to consider the consequences, the harm, absolutely. And when you look at this case, relators now conceded that there was no harm to Mr. Wong. He's testified now twice that he's never complained of her services or was upset with Ms. Dougherty in any way. His liquor permit was not delayed by the conduct at all. So we've got the Temple Tefereth Israel. There was an article that occurred in the dispatch. The president of the organization received approximately 5 phone calls from some folks in the congregation. He sent out a letter to the congregation explaining that that was not an authorized event, and has testified from that point forward the matter was closed. So those were the consequences. And keep in mind, too, that this happened as a result of a forgery by one of its own members, Mr. Masser.
What is the significance, in your view, of the testimony, I guess, of the chief legal counsel at the Division of Liquor Control that I'm quoting here from the relator's brief, that we then rely on the fact that the attorney has reviewed the application and is in agreement that there are no errors or misrepresentations, saying that they look upon a notarized document, a document notarized by a lawyer, as being significant. Is that significant or not?
I'm not sure of the significance of that, quite frankly. At the conclusion of that testimony, this pattern of fraud claim were unanimously dismissed by the panel. So I don't know, quite frankly, I don't know what impact that testimony had on anything. State agencies and courts are entitled to rely on documents filed by attorneys, and so it's appropriate for that reliance to occur. But Mr. Patisse's specific testimony in that regard had no bearing on the issues in this case, as evidenced by the fact that this pattern of fraud claim that we've been dealing with for years now was dismissed at the close of the evidence. We've talked about the harm issue and the lack of intent. I want to talk for a minute about the mitigation because, as Relator acknowledges, public reprimand in a notary violation case is appropriate when it's isolated and when there's mitigating factors. We believe we've satisfied the isolated aspect. The board has twice found that. With respect to mitigation, no prior disciplinary violations in 22 years of practice. Ms. Dougherty was not motivated by greed or dishonesty. She did not act out of self-interest or personal gain. Strong character evidence was presented at the first hearing. The board found that this was a single incident, which was not likely to occur again. And I guess the last factor that I'd like to mention, maybe the most for unique to this case, is the fact that Ms. Dougherty has acknowledged her wrongdoing 4.5 years ago. Tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees later, 2 hearings before the panel, 2 hearings before this court, and we're back to square one in this case, that it's a notary violation, nothing more. So we believe that
Counsel, are you saying that we've all caused an inconvenience to your client and an expense that was unwarranted?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I'm just pointing out the fact that for years we heard about these fraud claims, pattern of fraud claims by relator. This court let that case proceed on remand. They had years to bring forward that evidence. And as I stood before this court a few years ago and said there was no evidence of that, after having all that time, there was, at the end of the day, at the close of the case in chief, there was no evidence at all, and it was unanimously dismissed. So it's not a matter of inconvenience. I'm just trying to explain to this court that financially, emotionally, this case has been weighing on Ms. Dougherty for 4.5 years. That's the only point I'm trying to make. The case law that we cite to in our brief supports the public reprimand. Anything beyond that is pure punishment in this case. The case law cited, there's a litany of cases cited in Relator's brief, we believe, that are factually very distinguishable, and I think has been acknowledged here this morning that some of those cases are distinguishable. So we ask that at most this is a public reprimand case and that Relator's objection be denied. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. Ms. McClain, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
I would just like to take a brief minute to address the respondent's argument that the case law they've cited supports a public reprimand. If memory serves me correctly, the respondent has cited the 6 different cases in which a public reprimand was issued. But I want to point out that three of those cases involve situations where the respondent actually had the client's authority to sign the individual's name, but simply failed to note that before notarizing the document. And in two of those cases, the respondent took an opportunity, once the violation was brought to his or her attention, to cure the defect. In two cases that the respondent cites, the respondent secured the client's signature to a blank affidavit before the facts were actually filled in. Those facts aren't existent here. In one of those cases, there wasn't even a violation of Disciplinary Rule 1-102A4. So I'm not sure that the respondent's argument that these cases support the public reprimand in this particular situation.
Although the Reisenfeld case, there were two attorneys. One received a public reprimand. Right. One received a six-month stay.
Yes.
And it appeared to be, the court said, isolated incidents, so more than one. But it appeared that there was no harm to the client, and they did not intend harm.
But I thought it was significant that one of the respondents in that case received a public reprimand. The other received a six-month state suspension because, and the court cited to this fact, that some of the information contained in the affidavit was inaccurate, which is just what we have in this case here.
Which was supplied by the attorney.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McQueen. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.
Thank you.